Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, the producer of the show, and would like to welcome you to Clinical Air episode number 9, Investing in the Future of Clinical Research. Our Clinical Air series host is Craig Lipset, head of clinical innovation, R&D, Pfizer. And our guests include Todd Pietri, who's co-founder at Milestone Ventures, and Jeremy Sohn, managing director at MPM Capital. For more information about our previous radio shows and conferences, please visit www.theconferenceforum.org. So welcome, everyone. And Craig, I will let you take over.
Thank you very much, Val, and welcome, everyone, to episode number 9 of Clinical Air. If you have not had the opportunity to be with us before, please take a look at the Conference Forum website or the Blog Talk Radio website or the iTunes site that has our information or even on Stitcher. The 8 prior episodes have really been some great conversations, continuing that theme, informal, unscripted, with interesting people doing some amazing things around the conduct of clinical trials and getting our medicines through development and into the hands of patients. We've spoken with leaders from pharma companies, from Eli Lilly and Sanofi and others. We've spoken with innovators like Adam Dole, Presidential Innovation Fellow from the White House, patient activists, entrepreneurs with interesting technologies. And today, we get to carry that theme over to a very important stakeholder in that process, the investor, and making sure that this area, this field of developing new medicines is exciting to investors so that it can actually be sustaining. I should mention, as I always do, that I'm Craig Lipset, and I am your host, but my day job is with Pfizer, and while I like to hope that the opinions expressed align with those. They don't necessarily always, and so the opinions I'll share do represent my own. And our guests today, as we delve into this topic of interest from the venture community and continuing to build this space, we have Jeremy Sohn from MPM Capital and Todd Pietri from Milestone. These are two leaders from two very well-respected and highly regarded VCs. So I'm really thrilled to have them both, and I'm also thrilled to have them both because they get this space. These are two people that understand not only the life sciences, because clearly the venture community gets biotech and therapeutics and diagnostics, but they go a level deeper and get the development process and the opportunities that many of our listeners are challenged with every day around trying to get these medicines through clinical trials, getting data generated, getting evidence submitted to regulators and payers, getting medicines into the hands of patients. So with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Jeremy and Todd. Welcome to Clinical Air, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Great. Thank you,
Jeremy,
for having us.
Jeremy, why don't I start with you? What led you into this particular space, not only thinking about investing in the life sciences, but putting an additional edge on that and also thinking about this development in the conduct of clinical trials?
Sure. Well, let me start by explaining that MPM Capital, we're a venture capital firm, primarily based in Boston, but also with a strong office in San Francisco. And for the last 15 years, the firm has been focused primarily around traditional biopharmaceutical, biotech investment, so pipeline development for life sciences. And that's really been sort of the core area of strength. And about 2 years or so ago, as a result of our strong relationships with pharma, who we work with day in and day out, we were encouraged to increasingly think more about technology. At the end of the day, certainly Pipeline development is a critical element of what we do, but the increasing cost of bringing products to market and the increasing complexity associated with bringing products to market and, you know, and the timelines that, you know, continue to expand, it's increasing concern to pharma, not just to look at sort of the revenue and the product, you know, pipeline aspect of their business, but also the cost and efficiency aspect of their business. And since we really understand what it takes to bring products to market and where are going to be successful products, they thought it made a lot of sense for us to also help them think about where technology innovation can influence and create efficiencies therein. And so it was really our interest in this space is really an offshoot of you know, these core strategic interests of pharma over the last years and the relationships that we have there.
So is it a hedge? Do you expect this to be that success here will just be an enabler of some of your other investments in therapeutics or diagnostics, or do you believe that this area has legs on its own?
No, I think that's a great question. You know, I think that, you know, right now these two areas are somewhat independent. But, you know, when you, I'm sure, you know, this is an area that you speak about a lot, and I think most pharma shares in the context of sort of the future of the pharmaceutical industry and the future of drugs is, you know, has this notion of beyond the pill. And so there will be at some point, and I don't want to put a stake in the ground and say whether it's 2 years, 5 years, or 15 years from now, but there will be a point where, you know, the notion of drug companies simply being, you know, drugs, I think is, you know, we all recognize this is not going to be true. And so whether there's some combination of, you know, personalized medicine associated with, you know, drugs in combination with devices or sensors or, you know, software application technology or, you know, a whole suite of services, I think that there is going to be that convergence. And so certainly down the road, we do see that. Right now, we you know, that said, I think right now we see that there's tremendous opportunity, you know, for both of these, you know, businesses to operate and sort of, you know, be self-sustaining, you know, independent.
Thanks. Todd, can you tell us a little bit about Milestone and what's led you into this space?
Sure. Milestone Venture Partners, I co-founded it with Ed Goodman in 2000, and we've raised a series of small funds. We now manage about $108 million, and we invest in early stage software and data services businesses, essentially, delivered over the internet or through mobile devices or some combination. We specialize in digital health investments, so software and data services for biopharma, providers, both hospitals and physician groups, payers, both self-insured employers and health plans, and some consumer-facing or patient-facing businesses. Within biopharma, we, you know, made our first investments some time ago in Medidata and Octagon, and we have stayed close to the industry ever since because those were successful investments for us, and they were our first healthcare investments, and that really actually led our firm into investing into digital health more broadly. And you know, we've definitely seen some cycles, some good ones and some bad ones, in the biopharma sector, and we've learned over time, you know, which you know, places that, you know, areas we like and we like much less. But clinical development is where a heck of a lot of the money is. It's where a lot of the inefficiencies are and where a lot of the potential is. So, you know, we continue to evaluate new business opportunities there.
That sounds like some pretty cool experience. Those are some companies that are household names to many in the clinical trial space today.
Absolutely. Yeah, when we invested in Medidata, it was $1 million revenue business, and you know, it's now about a $275 million business. It's you know, it's really the first and probably the best example of a vertical SaaS company or an industry cloud company, a company that provides its software over the internet in a defined vertical. That was not always fashionable. You know, venture capitalists frequently used to look at, you know, vertical software players as sort of niche-y and, you know, less investable, and whereas today that's much less the case. In fact, you know, it's actually seen as a strength or an advantage. And you see it not only in Medidata in the pharma sector, but you also see it in Veeva, you know, with you know, the high growth and high valuations.
You know, Todd, when many look at innovators in this space, they often think that the barriers in this space are unique, they're different, they're high. We've got regulatory considerations that, as a result, most new developments, maybe they're only going to come from existing incumbent large companies, the Oracles and Quintiles out there who know this space rather than some clever young innovator that can slip in and disrupt. Did Medidata prove otherwise, or are they an outlier? Is it realistic that others could overcome some of those perceived barriers and be successful in this space?
I think it's realistic, although it remains a question. I mean, when we invested in Medidata, there were many clinical trials. Actually, the term of art was electronic data capture at the time. You know, there were many companies that had been funded and were competing, and the Medidata guys simply were better at developing, you know, elegant software, doing one thing, you know, very, very well initially, and winning over clients with a better, you know, product roadmap and service kind of ethic. And I remember doing the early due diligence calls, you know, where, you know, we spoke to companies, you know, that are very well known. I probably shouldn't say, but they had assembled very impressive teams, due diligence teams, to evaluate, you know, the vendors, and, you know, so they were looking at Phase Forward, which had raised tens of millions of dollars. You know, Medidata had raised, you know, $1 million maybe of angel money while we were doing due diligence before we had invested, and you know, there was real question as to whether or not you want to go with the platform, you know, the company that is doing everything or intends to do everything versus a point solution that does one thing very well. And, you know, the conclusion of this very well-known biotech company was that, you know, they intended to buy the best-of-breed point solutions. And that really gave, you know, Medidata their break because they were able to get in and land and secure the trust of the customer, and then expand, and to where today, of course, the irony is that they're the platform company today, and then you have a lot of small companies that would like to, you know, chip off pieces of their platform and do it better than Medidata, and so that's still the tension. It's just that Medidata is now in the position of incumbent, you know, giant, and there are younger companies that would like to do, you know, more isolated, you know, solve more isolated problems. And then grow their business, and that's still a question. You know, who's on the right side of history there? And that's the decision of the venture capitalists. But I would say broadly, you know, venture capitalists that's how they make their money, is by betting on the small guy that can figure out a way to innovate in some dark corner and then turn that into a bigger business.
Jeremy, I have to believe that you're in a similar place, that you have to believe that these barriers are surmountable, that regulatory and compliance considerations are challenges, but companies, innovators can overcome them and succeed here. What kinds of things do you think about or look for in that regard?
You know, I think Todd, you know, made a lot of important points, and you know, I think some of the things, if you think about from a venture capitalist perspective, you know, and for that matter, even from a disruptive innovation perspective, there is always room for the little guy to, you know, find their way within the marketplace. Medidata was a great example. They chose maybe not to, you know, go after big, it sounds like, and I don't know the example specifically, but it sounds like they chose not to go after maybe the top three big pharma, but to go out, you know, go after a large biotech firm, which may be, you know, from a culture perspective, more innovative and less, you know, risk adverse, and then use that as a means to, you know, develop validity in the marketplace to a point where, you know, large pharma was willing to, you know, stand behind the risk profile of innovative technology. And that kind of disruptive innovation is, you know, certainly makes sense, you know, from everything we know about, you know, how early stage companies, you know, tend to disrupt incumbencies. You know, we certainly, you know, believe that path as well. And, you know, and to be honest, I think, you know, there's another dynamic as well, which is, you know, a lot of these larger companies and, you know, tend not to do well with innovative technologies. Once they become platform companies, they, you know, there's a tremendous amount of effort to continue to advance the existing platform and to support the existing platform, but also not necessarily to disrupt the existing platform with lower cost solutions or with potentially, you know, disruptive solutions. You know, metadata or the EDC market right now is actually a great example. I mean, there are other companies out there trying to disrupt the EDC market with, you know, call it point of service, handheld devices, e-source kinds of solutions that remove the traditional EDC model. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are, within the next couple of years, a number of companies that successfully do that. But there are reasons why the large EDC companies don't necessarily want to be the first movers in that market. It's a lower-cost model. It potentially disrupts their you know, a lot of the risk validation that they've already done in the marketplace and sort of their value proposition in the marketplace. So from a VC perspective, we're excited about it. And I think that, you know, as we begin to get traction in some of these smaller companies, you know, the larger incumbents will more than likely acquire, you know, one or more of the smaller companies in order to remain competitive and in order to avoid, you know, potentially the path of you know, a large, a smaller company becoming a large disruptive large company.
Jeremy, for the entrepreneur out there, what is it that you look for when you're considering some of these opportunities, and where do you look for them? So, for instance, is the old adage that that venture invests in people, not necessarily ideas. Does that still hold water, or what attributes do you look for when considering an opportunity?
You know, I think that's absolutely still true for a whole host of reasons. You know, great technologies don't necessarily make great companies, and it really is you know, the individuals, the executive management team, the you know, the overall team, you know, that proves to be the people that you want to invest in. So, you know, from our perspective, we do very much look at making sure that we have the right team around the table that we're investing behind. You know, there's a lot of early stage investment in Boston, which is where we're based. I will be the first to tell you that you know, between looking at a extraordinarily smart, you know, MIT Harvard grad has got a fantastic idea, and an experienced executive management team that's got, you know, an equally good idea, but maybe, you know, slightly less innovative technology, it would be a hard decision for us. For the reasons that that I just alluded to. I think at the end of the day, so much more success is not necessarily driven by, you know, the best technology, but by the right, you know, by the right approach, by the right team, by the right, you know, proven execution model. And in life sciences in particular, because of, you know, the complexities of the space, whether they're regulatory or just long sales cycles or simply understanding the workflows associated with it, having that right team in place is pretty paramount.
Are there places you like to go to look for opportunities? Do you believe in some of the health tech incubators that are out there? Do you prefer to try to greenhouse things a bit more internally?
You know, it's great. There are you know, phenomenal incubators, and I won't name them, but you know, certainly Boston and Chicago and San Francisco and other places, New York. There are fantastic incubators out there, and I've been impressed, actually, with the transition in the model itself, because I was concerned, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that sort of the incubation angel model wasn't providing enough capital to get the companies to, you know, an appropriate set of milestones to be able to successfully raise Series A and Series B, you know, from a traditional venture capital. So I think that side of the market has evolved very, very well. At NPM, although we do look at and spend a lot of time with the incubators, our success has largely been driven by incubating companies internally. And so, and this was driven really from, you know, our biopharmaceutical investment model, where oftentimes we'll work closely with our large pharma partners and investors and scientific advisory board. We'll generate ideas, and we will then make a strategic decision to invest in a certain area and in a certain idea, and oftentimes pull together our own executive management team and found companies. So in fact, at NPM, since I joined about 15 months or so ago, I've been responsible for starting two new companies in the, call it, you know, mobile and big data health space. And, you know, that's not to say that we exclusively look to incubate our own companies, but it certainly is an area where we're probably more comfortable. And just one corollary to that, one of the reasons why we're comfortable with that model is oftentimes, you know, I would say the most important part of our validation process, our due diligence process, is we will make sure that we've got our first customer and oftentimes strategic investor from pharma lined up as we're incubating the company. So we know that we've defined appropriately the problem in the marketplace, we've defined appropriately the solution or the potential solution in the marketplace, and we've got a first customer at a corporate level, at an executive level, willing to adopt the technology and the platform once it's ready for commercialization. So we sort of, you know, very much de-risked a lot of, you know, sort of the early aspects of an early-stage company.
Thanks, Jeremy. Todd, what about from your perspective, that whole theme of what you look for in an opportunity and where do you find them? What do you tell innovators or entrepreneurs in this space? Is it still the people over the idea? Or are there places you like to go to try to surface those opportunities?
Well, what we're looking for is, I think that, you know, obviously you have to have, you know, an exceptional team. You have to have a good product or technology and, you know, right business model. But the one thing that I'd say that where we spend a disproportionate amount of time trying to figure out in our due diligence process is how attractive the market opportunity is. You know, and what makes a market attractive, you know, could be, you know, different things. It could be, you know, its size. It could be its growth. It could be it undergoing dramatic change, or it could be a combination. So, you know, we do, you know, spend a fair amount of time trying to speak to customers and industry folks to figure out if there is, you know, white space, and there will be wind in your sails, you know, once you make the investment. In terms of growing the business, because, you know, you can augment management, the product, you can tweak the business model. You know, it's hard to change the inherent market opportunity. You can pivot and go to a different market, but that sometimes involves, you know, a restart and additional capital and so forth. So we pay very close attention to the market. In terms of where we find opportunities, I mean, we've been in business for a long time. A lot of the investments that we've made over the years are sources of new deal flow, because we sit on the boards, you know, with these entrepreneurs for some time. They ultimately exit. There's interesting board members on the team that we've come to know from different parts of the industry. There's members of management that go on to do new things. So we have kind of a network and an ecosystem of folks that you know, feeds us new opportunities. We do spend time with the incubators and accelerators and the like. You know, here in New York, you see Blueprint and Startup Health a good bit. On the West Coast, you see Rock Health. Chicago, you see I guess it's the Blues Health Box. And what's the one in Boston, Jeremy? Is there one in Boston? Is Rock Health in Boston?
Rock Health, I think, also has a place in Boston. There's Health Box, which is associated with some of the insurance companies. There are a couple others as well.
Yeah, there's some other conferences in Boston that are interesting. So, I mean, you do have, and I think HealthBox has moved to Nashville as well, and I want to say even Europe. So we've spent time with some more than others. We also are investors in the New York Digital Health Accelerator. And the New York Digital Health Accelerator is made up of 23 different provider organizations, basically every large, you know, healthcare organization in the New York area, and then four different venture capitalists, some pharmaceutical companies are involved, some health plans are involved. And so we make an investment there. You know, we do a call for companies. We evaluate a bunch of different plans. And then we, you know, bring in a class of 8 to 10 companies. And the point of this accelerator, the way it's different from the other accelerators, is that they're really working and being mentored by potential customers, by the provider organizations in this instance. And so, you know, I think that's an innovative model and one where, you know, we get to see a bunch of different plans, whether they're admitted or not, frankly. And we also get to see where the different ideas are bubbling up. And so, you know, I think that's a good source of deal flow for us. And then, frankly, you know, the better deals we do, you know, the more success we have, that is acts as a magnet for entrepreneurs. So, you know, given that we've made you know, successful investments in Octagon Research and Medidata, you know, in the clinical trial automation space, you know, we tend to get to see a good number of those opportunities, unless, of course, they're super capital intensive, in which case, you know, the entrepreneur won't come to us because we're making small investments in small rounds that are early. But, you know, we do tend to see a lot of the best deals in that particular area because we've had good success there.
So, you know, that's really helpful. Thanks, Todd. The Jeremy mentioned teased a couple of areas that were that sound like they're very interesting and exciting right now. Not only in the whole healthcare health 2.0 connected health space, but also in clinical trials today, whether it's mobile or big data. Are there particular areas that you're excited about, Todd, right now that are either leveraging technologies in new ways or services in this space? Is there anything that's drawing your attention right now?
Well, we haven't made an investment in the clinical trial space for some time. We are evaluating a couple of different opportunities. And, you know, I think it's difficult for me to share that at present. But, you know, the perennial areas that, you know, I think matter or, you know, just come up over and over again in the clinical trial space is, you know, there is a problem with, you know, poor efficiency and failure and bloated costs in clinical trials. So, you know, businesses which are going to help reduce those costs, improve efficiencies, improve time to market, you know, are all sort of tried and true themes. I mean, I think that you know, the move toward, you know, more flexible or adaptive trials, you know, are, you know, is an important, you know, trend. I think that, you know, automating, you know, last year at the DPharm conference, a company presented, you know, in the area of payments, you know, sort of automating the financial aspect of trials, I think is an interesting area and a classic, you know, case of, you know, should the incumbent platform providers provide that or should startups disrupt and win that space? You know, I think that you know, the move toward, you know, a theme that always matters is how do you get patients into these trials? You know, how do you accrue patients? You know, so many trials, far too many, you know, fail to even enroll one patient, and a very large percentage, I forget the percent, but I want to say it's double digit, you know, fail to enroll enough patients. So, you know, we've seen, you know, businesses try to be agencies, try to be marketers for new patients. We've seen, you know, matching engines. We've seen, you know, companies that try to co-opt, you know, medical associations to try to mine their flow of members and marketing and PR to try to accrue patients. And so, you know, someone's going to figure that out, and someone's going to do that better and effectively. And so, you know, we do look at that, you know, using, you know, data to make better decisions, you know, big data, you know, I think is critical. And I'm curious, you know, Jeremy's piqued my interest with his big data investment. We made a big data investment on the pharma side very recently, a company called Trinity Pharma Solutions, which is more on the commercial side. Although, you know, being able to take in, but the themes there are I think, going to be applicable on the clinical trial side. So in other words, this company takes in data feeds from hundreds of sources. Some of them are internal, some of them are commercial sources, and some of them are from trading partners. And so when you pump in that much data, you have to transform it into something that is clean and more uniform and that can be then acted upon and analyzed. And then you have to push it out. And in pharma, you know, pharma has a love affair with mobile devices, iPads in particular. And so being able to pump out those analytics to a mobile form factor, you know, is just, you know, I think is you know, kind of right place, right time. So, you know, on the commercial side, we're seeing a lot of that. I think that we'll see more of that on the clinical side. And then just better workflow, you know, I think is a good area to focus on. So, you know, all of those things are in the mix.
Well, you got to believe if somebody can crack the nut on even a few of those, patient recruitment, among others, man, there's so much potential upside, you know, both for efficiency and productivity, but, you know, ultimately getting, you know, at the core, getting those therapeutics through to market, through to patients. Jeremy, you had teased a little bit around mobile and big data. What types of opportunities are exciting to you right now? Is it mostly around those digital platforms? Are there others related to services or technology that are particularly interesting to you right now?
Sure. excuse me. So there are a number of areas that are of interest. You know, Todd, you know, just touched on a lot of them, but let me try to touch on them as well. From a mobile perspective, you know, in particular with respect to you know, pharma and clinical trials, we do think that there's a lot of opportunity with respect to mobile. Most of mobile, in my understanding of the marketplace in terms of pharma, has been focused really less on the clinical trial side and more on the branded commercial side of the business. So there's been a tremendous amount of activity, and I think it's all interesting, but not necessarily from an investor perspective. On the clinical trial side, I think there's a real opportunity to innovate. You know, to innovate in a lot of different ways, you know, at a very basic level, I think there's a modernization of the clinical trial process that, you know, has been wanting for many years and should and does need to take place. And so we're very, you know, in the same way that, you know, Medidata and eSource, and for that matter, even, you know, PRO companies have been pushing to innovate, you know, the paper workflows, you know, the last, you know, 50 plus years, you know, I think that mobile has the opportunity to, you know, continue to accelerate some of those trends in meaningful ways. You know, and then using the mobile platform for doing some of the other things that really begin to, again, touch on some of the other concepts that I think, you know, Pat just alluded to in terms of, like, big data and big data capture. So, you know, the mobile platform becomes now, you know, an exciting way to be able to capture a lot more information. And that, you know, that's why we see a tremendous amount of activity on the consumer side. You know, certainly everything that Samsung and Apple and, you know, everyone else is doing, you know, in terms of the phone and the watch. You know, these platforms are very good in terms of centralizing, you know, data and aggregating data in terms of individual use and patterns. You know, there's still a big question, I think, in terms of how clinical trials and clinical trial teams will want to adopt the opportunity to expand their data capture capability. But, you know, I think having the right platform in place that's been fully data validated, you know, 21 CFR Part 11 validated, having, you know, some of the specific intended use cases regulated in terms of, you know, class 1, class 2, class 2 devices, having those platforms in place, I think, and validations in place and certifications in place is going to be important, you know, for when those pharmaceutical companies or specific trial teams are ready to fully take advantage of it. Yeah, and then again, as I alluded to earlier, I think that the notion of sort of beyond the pill and thinking about, you know, dynamic, you know, drug dosing, dynamic lifestyle changes, health and wellness changes in terms of the combination. We used to think about, you know, when we say combination therapy, we usually think about drug device. I think, you know, we need to think more beyond that. It'll be drug device, you know, app, you know, concept, you know, where, you know, again, 5 years from now, you know, that we'll begin to start seeing some of those types of, you know, combined solutions. So, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity on the mobile side. In terms of big data, let's separate that out into sort of two different areas. One is using data more effectively in terms of, you know, just overall clinical trial design and recruitment. This is, you know, probably recruitment is the single largest area of pain that I hear about from pharma. There are, you know, scores of solutions on the marketplace. You know, to me, what's still sort of surprising is that, you know, pulling the data into the workflow is still not uniformly adopted across pharma. So when people are designing their clinical trials and approving the protocols, they're not really thinking, they're not using a data-driven methodology. There's, you know, some research associated. There's, you know, called, you know, POC summits that take place, or, you know, you talk to knowledge leaders. But, you know, designing trials, validating your cohort segmentation, being able to understand which are your ideal sites to recruit, which, you know, where can you actually recruit potential patients, not in theory, but in actuality, that process is only taking place, I would say, in a small percentage of pharmaceutical companies, and even for those companies that are doing it, a small percentage of trials. I think that'll change, and there are some really interesting technology platforms that are being developed to address that. On the big data side, I think there's a lot of activity. I don't know yet if pharma really knows, again, what they're going to do with all of that data, whether it's data aggregated from social media or data aggregated just in general from sort of the whole health and wellness space, you know, blood pressure and weight monitoring and fitness tracking and all that other stuff, all very, very interesting, a tremendous amount of activity happening around there. I just don't know. I think pharma right now is an exploratory stage, and sort of the business model there is pretty untested. It's not clear to me yet that there's a lot of investment, but, you know, the long-term business model in terms of how it will actually pan out in terms of products and solutions is, I think, still a couple of years away. And then, you know, even beyond that, you've got a lot of what I think is increasingly going to be of interest is maybe we've crossed the chasm a little bit is in terms of omics. So not just sort of genomics, but also, you know, other types of omics, proteomics, metabolomics, you know, epigenetics, et cetera. And so, you know, and those areas are in various stages of maturity, but I think increasingly we're beginning to see that, you know, again, from a big data omics perspective, that pharma is beginning to understand a little bit more in terms of what data is actionable today and what data, you know, do they want to begin to, you know, continue to sort of track, you know, for it to be actionable in the future. And so, you know, this is an area that I have an interest in. We haven't yet sort of chosen any investment, but it certainly is an area that I think is beginning to mature, where, you know, 3 to 5 years ago, there's a lot of activity, but I think it was still a little bit too early on.
Wow. Wow. You just answered every remaining question I had on my in my mind. I think that is a wonderful synopsis of opportunities today as well as over the next few years, whether it's leveraging data, diverse data in new ways, touching from genomics to social media, all the way through to those types of that very realistic future that our therapies will start to look at these mobile and digital tools as companions, whether they are companion diagnostics or co-therapies that add a synergistic impact in improving patient outcomes in a meaningful enough way that they'll be compelling to regulators and payers. And, you know, I'm very, very excited about this journey that many research sponsors and in the innovator community with these tools are going down together to make that happen. Todd, are there any other futurist thoughts that you have in mind as you look at this space over the next 5 years?
Well, I just think that I want to just say how it's a meaningful opportunity. You know, the total life sciences IT spend is $45 billion. The data I have for global clinical development spend, phases 1 through 4, is, you know, $90 billion. Is there an $8 to $10 billion, you know, opportunity for technology companies, tackling some of these problems? And I think there's a very meaningful opportunity, and how that breaks down, you know, for clinical trials, you know, between study, you know, design, patient management, site management, trial management, you know, I think they're all, you know, multi-billion-dollar opportunities. So, I'm focused on finding our next metadata, and I'm confident we can do it, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it this morning.
That's great. Todd, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining in the conversation today. I know we have the chance to cross paths numerous places throughout the year, DPharm in Boston and otherwise, and I'll look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you both, and back over to you, Val.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Craig, Todd, and Jeremy. And Craig, Todd, and Jeremy will also be speaking at Mobile at DPharm, which takes place on September 10th in Boston. And the DPharm event, which is our Disruptive Innovations event to advance clinical trials, will happen September 11th and 12th in Boston. And for more information, visit www.theconferenceforum.org. Thank you so much, everyone, for a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you.